This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Is there a mic or something? No, there isn't. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salam ala rasulillah wa barak. Brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for attending this talk of mine. This is the first time I have come to Canterbury. Believe it or not, I've been in this country for nearly 20 years. And never had the chance to visit Canterbury. So when I was given this responsibility, I was told the University of Kent. I'm thinking, okay, I know Kent is in Britain, but where is Kent? So I know Essex, Kent, and there are other counties in this country, Middlesex, where I live. So I checked on the map, and then I checked the University of Kent, and it was right next, I mean, it is in Canterbury. So I was very pleased to see that it is in Canterbury, and I was intending to come and see the cathedral as well. Canterbury is a very special place in British history. It has been for a very long time. The Archbishop of Canterbury is effectively the Imam of the, you know, what we call the head of the Church of England in the spiritual sense. Of course, there was always, you know, friction between spiritual leaders and temporal leaders, kings and priests, or imams or people of religion have always been in a conflict, not always, but very often. But Canterbury is a very special place. The Archbishop of Canterbury is effectively the main guy or the main person in the Church of England. Currently, I don't remember the name of the Archbishop of Canterbury, but there was one before. Archbishop Rowan Williams, who was a scholar par excellence, who is a scholar, and he's alive, and he has written many books on Christian history. And one of them I looked at was Arianism. It was a Christian heresy, as the Orthodoxy sees it, in the early 4th century. So Canterbury is a very special place for, I don't want to lecture on Canterbury and its virtues, but it's a very special place, and I'll see if I can get some time afterwards to look at the cathedral as well. So it's the first time I've been here, and it is a very important topic I'm going to address tonight. And the topic I've been given or agreed to give or to deliver is Muslims without a vision. So this is a very unique topic in my opinion. You may have had lectures before where people come and talk about Islam and its place in the world and what Muslims are going through in the West in particular and in the world in general. This is a very, very interesting period in our history where a lot of problems have occurred in the Middle East in particular, and they are affecting the Muslims around the world. And then we have the problem of extremism, the problem of terrorism, the problem of reactionary movements, people where a lot of atrocities are being committed from all sides. I'm not saying only one side is responsible, from all sides, all people have lost the plot for some reason. There is something wrong with the world at the moment. You know, even the day before yesterday, or not some couple of days back, Security Council tried to bring some resolutions to stop what's happening in Aleppo in Syria. And because of one power, you know, this power vetoed any resolution, so nothing could take place, unfortunately. Nothing to stop the war in Syria could happen. So I don't want to turn this lecture into a political lecture, but this is the situation. I mean, everything affects us. As humans, we live on this globe, on this planet, and when we talk to each other, when we converse with each other, a lot of things are, you know, mentioned in discussions, some with knowledge, some without knowledge, some with prejudice, some without prejudice. So we should, as Muslims primarily, or as humans generally, you know, should try our best to be as objective as possible, as understanding as possible, and as responsible as possible when it comes to our own duties. So the topic I'm assuming most people here are Muslims, so I will talk about this topic, Muslims without a vision. So what do I mean by a vision? Vision is something that you look to do, or you look want, or you want to do in life. You want, you look up to something, or you want to do something. You want to achieve something in life, something great, hopefully. That you want to become, let's say, when you start your education at university, you want to do something with it. Okay, you should have a vision. If you don't have a vision, then you should start thinking of a vision. Because a lot of the times what happens in Asian families in particular, because most Muslims in this country come from the Asian background, Pakistani, Bengali, or possibly Indian, and then other lands, of course, the Arabs. A lot of the families, a lot of the parents, they choose your careers for you. You know, your parents tell you as to what you should study. It's not the other way around. I came across a very funny image on Facebook once, that there was a child with a very angry face. It's like a newborn baby, and the child has a very angry face, and there's a caption on it. You know, like a lot of people do these memes. Are they called memes? Right? So they put a caption on it. The child is saying, "Bro, I was only born 10 minutes ago, and you want me to be a doctor or engineer," right? So as soon as the child is born, the parents are discussing as to what the child will be, what we want the child to be, or what we want the child to study, the family we want the child to get married in. You know, all these discussions are taking place, right? So uncles and aunts turn up and they say, "Oh, she or he will get married to my child." Okay, so the child has no idea what's going on. So this is a very common occurrence, and it's quite cultural, unfortunately, in our cultures. But something should be changed. I mean, this attitude must change. We should allow our own children to choose their careers, to choose their future, to choose their vision. So when you educate yourselves, primarily, the first question I want to address is, educate yourselves for the mind, not for the stomach. A lot of the people come to university, they want to study because they want to get a job eventually. Everyone is talking about a career. Everyone is talking about getting a job. I want to be able to find a good job and then make good money and then buy a house and buy a car and eventually get married if you find a partner. And then live your life happily ever after, yes? Happily ever after. That's what people think will happen. But if you study something without interest in it, then you may not fully benefit from that subject. I have learned this from experience. When I was a teenager, in those days, IT was an upcoming field with a lot of money involved in it. People were getting a ridiculous amount of money for working in the IT field. One of my cousins, he was on £50 an hour, and everyone was like pointing fingers, "Oh, look at that guy. Everyone should study IT because he has such an amazing job. He's driving a Porsche," and he bought a Porsche at that time in the late 90s, and everyone was going crazy. So I tried it. I failed because I had no interest in IT. So I always loved history, and I started to read history, and then I went to the uni and studied history, and it was like a walk in the park because I had so much passion for my subject. I loved it. I never felt pressure or burdened by my studies because I loved it. I loved what I was doing. And likewise, my brother, he loves wildlife. You know, he loves watching documentaries on wildlife in Africa, lions and giraffes and zebras, and he will tell you exactly how many types of tigers we have in the world. You know, they tell you Siberian tiger and the features about it, and then the Sumatran tiger and the Bengal tiger. We'll tell you all about that. And he hasn't been to university to study this. And sometimes I really get, you know, fascinated by his level of knowledge in this field. So when it came, when his time came to join a university, everyone told him, "Law, go and study law because barristers are making a lot of money. They're making a lot of money. So go into law." So I told him, "No, don't go into law. If you don't like law, if you have no idea what law is, don't study law. Go and study zoology." And everyone started laughing. "Okay, well, zoology? You want him to become a vet or something?" I said, "No, this is what he loves. This is what he likes. This is what he has passion for. So let him do it." And he tried his luck in law for a year and he dropped out. You know, naturally. So this is what I'm trying to explain, that when you study, make sure you study what you want to study, and then you will benefit from it. So first thing is, have passion for your field. And if you have no particular field, if you have no passion for a particular field of studies, then try to create some passion for the field you are already studying, because you are in a university right now and you've chosen your subjects. So try as much as possible to instill some passion within your minds for the fields you are already studying and excel. So what can you do with your education is one of the questions I want to address. Education is the solution, to my knowledge, in my opinion, according to my experience. I've been around the world, I've traveled around the Middle East and some parts of Africa, and I've been to over 30 countries. I've met many people, many academics, many politicians, many leaders, been to many universities around the world, and I believe that education will solve our problems. The more we promote education in the world, the more we will live in prosperity. And this is what our legacy is, Islam. Look at the Muslim history. The first revelation, the Quran, was about education. Yeah. Prophet Muhammad is a man who has never been to a school, never been to an academy. He doesn't know what a school looks like. He's never been taught in any particular field of knowledge. And he's in this cave, so are we told in Islamic literature. He's in this cave and he receives the revelation from God. The first revelation that came to him is chapter 96 of the Quran, first 5 verses. And the first commandment is what? Read. Read in the name of your Lord. And then we are told in the same book in the Quran that he is foretold. Prophet Muhammad was actually foretold in the previous scriptures. And this is how we Muslims see, this is our perspective. The Quran makes a very clear point in this regard. In chapter 7, verse 157, Quran, the Quran states, يَجِدُونَهُمْ مَكْتُوبًا عِنْدَهُمْ فِي التَّوْرَاةِ وَالْإِنْجِيلِ. They find him mentioned with them in the Gospel, in the Torah. So the Jew... So this debate has been taking place for the last 14 centuries since Islam has emerged on the global scene, and Muslim scholars have been debating Christian scholars and Jewish scholars throughout the history of Islam whether Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam is actually truly mentioned in the previous scriptures or not. So there are some passages we point to, and one of those passages is very interesting, which is in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah was a prophet who lived somewhere around 9th century BC or 8th century BC. Okay, and there's a book called the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament. In the scripture of the Jews as well as the Christians. In the book of Isaiah, we have chapter 29, and the verse 12 states literally, and I quote, "When the book is given to the one who is not learned, and it is said to him, 'Read,' he will say, 'I am not learned. I am not learned.'" So the Muslim scholars claim that this passage in the book of Isaiah is actually referring to Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and what happened to him in the cave. So when he was in the cave of Hira, when he was 40, the angel appeared to him, so are we told in our literature, in our tradition, in Sahih al-Bukhari to be more precise, in Kitab al-Wahid, the very first chapter of Bukhari, the book of Revelation. And as we all know, if you don't know, I'll tell you that Bukhari is the most authoritative book for Muslims after the Quran itself, okay? And the first chapter, because it's the prophetic tradition, it has things from the Prophet and about him. So people, his companions, have transmitted knowledge about Prophet Muhammad, what they saw in him, what they heard from him, and what they saw him agree to. So he was in the cave, and the angel appeared to him and said to him, "Read." And he said, "Ma ana biqari," in the Arabic language, which means exactly, "I cannot read. I am not learned. I am not learned. I am not read." Okay. And then the first five verses of the Quran are given to him as a revelation. So this is how the civilization of Islam began. This is exactly what the beginning of Islam is. Read, proclaim, recite. Okay? And they started to read. Now a book is given to a man who has never been to a school, never been to a university. And a book is revealed to him and he's reading it every single day. And he's teaching it to his companions, his immediate companions, who are learning the book directly from him. And they are now reading. They become a bookly person. From being a bookless person, because the Arabs, prior to this particular event, had a very strong literary tradition, which we know as the Arabic poetry. The pre-Islamic Arabic poetry to this day is the best poetry in the Arabic language. Okay? And it is also known as, a collection is known as Mu'allakat. Mu'allakat or Sab'a Mu'allakat. Seven collections. The word Mu'allak actually means hanging. Okay? So why are they called Mu'allakat? Because in the Kaaba, the sanctuary of Mecca, where we all go for pilgrimage even today, in the pre-Islamic Arabian culture, they cherished their poets. The Arabs loved their poets and their poetry. So some of the best poets, their collections were actually hung on the walls of the Kaaba. They were hanging in the Kaaba, in the actual sanctuary, so the people could read and learn and memorize them. That's why they were called Mu'allakat, the hanging literature, basically. And there were seven in total, seven collections of poets, and they were memorized. But they had no written culture as such. The Arabs were not a bookly people. They did not carry books, they did not read books, they did not indulge in book reading. On the other hand, we had the Byzantines in the land of Syria and beyond. They were a very bookly people. The Christians had a strong, rich tradition of writing and reading books. So what we know today as codex form, you know, when you pick up a book, if you have one here, it was called codex. You know, between two covers, you put pages and you start reading and writing. Prior to that, the system was based upon scrolls. The Jewish people were using scrolls, so were the Alexandrians, and even the Egyptians were using scrolls. They did not codify the books. Christians started to codify books, and they started to read and write. So the Arabs were not a bookly people. You will not find any trace of any books written in the Arabic language prior to the Quran. No trace whatsoever. None. Non-existent. And then this books come. And then this book comes to them, this culture, these people. They start reading, they start writing, they start memorizing. Kids as young as 5, 6, 4 going to what they call the madrasa, or the, not the madrasa of today, unfortunately. The word madrasa has become very negative today. And there are reasons for that, and we are to blame, the Muslims are to blame for that as well. I don't take the blame away from Muslims. Because madrasa in the Middle Ages or in the medieval period was known as something great. Early universities, they were known as early universities. There is a scholar called George Maqdisi who has written extensively on this topic, as to how the Arabic madrasa model inspired the modern European school or college system, right? And universities or the institutions of higher learning were actually inspired by what was taking place in Spain during the Middle Ages. So the madrasa system at the time, during the Middle Ages when it started, was something different to what we have today. Okay? Names are exactly the same, but the realities were different. So these kids were going and they were learning, and then they became the torchbearers of knowledge and ethics and morals and kind and compassionate behavior throughout the world. The Muslim civilization cannot be separated from the Quran. The Quran is at the root of the Muslim civilization, what we know today as the Islamic or the Muslim civilization. And if you want to envision the Muslim civilization, start talking about Al-Andalus, for example, the Golden Age. Even for the Jewish people, some of the most prominent figures in the Jewish history came from Al-Andalus, from Spain, from the Arabic Spain. The Arabs or the Muslims governed parts of Spain for almost 7 centuries. For 3 centuries, they governed majority of the Iberian Peninsula, and then for 7 centuries, almost some parts of it, because lands were taken and then reconquered and lost and then reconquered. So wars were taking place between Northern Europeans and the Arabs in the south of Spain. So this period is known even in the Jewish history as the Golden Age, because some of the most important and learned Jewish scholars were born under the umbrella of Islamic Spain. Okay, one of them is Musa bin Maimun, also known as Maimonides. In the Jewish tradition, he's known as Rambam. Okay, I know that's, you know, the name doesn't sound very pleasant, but this is how he was known in the Jewish tradition. And he's also known as the second Moses, because he's so important in the Jewish history as a rabbi, as a traditionist, that he is given the name second Moses. And he wrote in the Arabic language. Okay, some of the best Jewish poets were born in Al-Andalus. Judah Halevi is a very famous, some of the best politicians and intellectuals, people like Samuel Hanage was born in Granada or Granada, which was the last state Muslims lost in Spain. It was lost in 1492, the very year Christopher Columbus landed on the Americas, although he didn't land in the, well, it was Haiti. You know, a hurricane in Haiti. You know about it? You watch news? Yes. Do you? Do you watch news? If you don't, please do. It is very important to know what's going on. Haiti has been hit by a very severe hurricane. It's called Hurricane Matthews. I don't know why it's called Matthews, but okay. Many people have died, and thousands have been made homeless. So if you can help them in any way. Now, I will come to the vision now. This is where the vision comes in. Muslims without a vision, right? So the vision is coming, right? I'm going to talk about the vision. So what I'm doing right now is still my introduction, okay? The foreword to the book. Okay, subhanAllah. So this was the Islamic civilization, to put it in a nutshell. All the universities, all the hospitals, all the great work on philosophy, science, theology, poetry, history, you name it, Muslims were writing books and accumulating libraries. To give you one example, Hakam II, one of the Muslim kings in Spain, had the largest library on the planet accumulated to date. Okay, so he was alive in the 10th century. Okay, he had a library of 400,000 volumes in Cordoba. Okay, 40 volumes alone, 40 volumes alone documented the names of the books he had in his library. And he had agents running around the world in Baghdad, in Damascus, and in as far as India, collecting books for him. Because he was a rich man, he was a king, he had the money, so he had agents running around collecting books for him. Right? Same was happening in Baghdad in the 9th century when Mamun initiated a translation movement. And he established an institution called Baytul Hikmah, the House of Wisdom. Why was it called the House of Wisdom? Because all the works of Greek philosophers, Indian mathematics, and Chinese wisdom were being translated. Not that there were any short of wisdom at the time, but it was curiosity. It was curiosity. We should learn great things from other cultures. That was the attitude. And that's why many people were put together in this place, in this institution, to start translating the books. And this is how many works of Aristotle were preserved. many works of Aristotle are only known in the Arabic language. They have been lost. The originals, the Greeks have been lost, the Greek works have been lost, and what we do have are Greek translations made from the Arabic language. And Aristotle was completely unknown to the West, completely unknown to the West. He was reintroduced to the West. I'm talking about the Middle Ages. Of course he was known to the West when he was alive. You know, there was a rich tradition even after that. But the Greeks stopped influencing the Western thinking, came to rise. Christian scholars or Christian leaders looked down upon Greek philosophy and it was rejected. And there are many stories I can tell in this regard. But the Arabs brought it back in commentaries, Ibn Rushd and Ibn Sina and Ibn Nafis, sorry, not Ibn Nafis, what's this person's name? I forgot his name. Okay, if the name comes back, I'll share it with you later on. Okay, so there are many names like that, people who criticized Greek philosophy. They wrote original works on philosophy. They presented their own philosophy in the Islamic garb. So philosophy was taken from Greeks and Indians, and then it was Islamified and then given to the Muslims, and many Western philosophers also benefited. Now people from Britain, from this very island, were traveling to the Muslim lands such as Syria, Egypt, as well as Spain to accumulate knowledge. We have people like Adelard of Bath. This man was alive in the 12th century. He had traveled to the Middle East and he was an Arabist. He had learned the Arabic language, came back and taught philosophy here in Britain and science. There was another man called Daniel of Morlaix who had traveled to Spain, studied in Toledo. Toledo was predominantly a Muslim city during the Middle Ages until it was taken by the Catholics in 1086. 1086 was the year when Toledo was taken back. And then what happened? Lo and behold, a huge library was found in Toledo, and some Christian scholars who were Latinists, they came in and they started to translate these Arabic works into Latin. So many translations, in the hundreds, were made for the rest of the Europeans. So there was a man called Robert of Ketton, who was also an Englishman. He translated the works of Jabir bin Hayyan, who had written in chemistry, on chemistry. And Robert of Ketton was the first person to have translated Jabir's works in Latin. Then we have another man called Robert the Scot. From the name you can tell he was a Scotsman. So he had translated many Arabic works into Latin. The first ever Latin translation of the Quran was made by Robert of Ketton. Peter the Venerable, who was a bishop in France, had requested from Robert to translate the Quran into Latin so that we can read what's in the Quran, to have a view on Islam, an accurate view on Islam, so that we can understand and criticize Islam. Because, you know, because of the Crusades, there was a lot of tension between the Muslim world and the Christian world at the time, and Christians wanted to understand the opponent, right? And there are books written on this very topic. It's a fascinating topic, how the West saw Muslims and Islam. And one of the books I strongly recommend is by a British scholar called Daniel Norman. Daniel Norman has written a book titled Islam and the West, Making of an Image, a masterpiece, an absolutely amazing work of history, written with high level of integrity and objectivity. So I strongly recommend this book, those of you who are interested in history. So this is how the Muslims brought a lot of positive to the world. And I'm only giving you a few examples, passingly. The details have to be found in some of the books I have mentioned. There's another book I strongly recommend for those who are interested in this topic. It is titled The Matter of Arabi in Medieval England. Okay? The book is titled again The Matter of Arabi. Arabi spelled with A as A-R-A-B-Y. In Medieval England, and the author is Dorothy Metlitsky. She has written this book, and she specifically deals with how Muslims and English scholars during the Middle Ages were interacting. So a lot of the rhetoric you hear on the news and on the tongues of some very unfortunate, ignorant people, that Muslims have suddenly emerged in this country in the 50s, and you know, they have suddenly become a problem for our country. That's not the case. Muslims, Islam and Muslims have been around from the very beginning of England. When I say England, England in particular, I mean, of course, Britain consists of four countries, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, and England. But England, of course, this is where the capital, London, is. This is where most of the people are. The population of England is a lot more than Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland. So England is, for that reason, has been very important historically. So when English identity started to form, the Muslims were there. And Muslims helped shape this identity. This is something you have to know. Living in this country, we have to study the tradition and our contribution as Muslims to the society and to the history and to the well-being and to the academic excellence and the intellectual history of this land. We have to understand it so that we can actually explain to our counterparts that this is what we have done. And we are not someone, of course, in large numbers, we turned up in the 60s, in the 50s, no doubt. But we have always been there from the day one. So one of the most powerful English kings, let's talk about English identity now. The English people actually come from predominantly two tribes, Angles and Saxons, right? That's why the English people are known as Anglo-Saxons, right? Angles and Saxons. And Saxons came from Germany, understandably so. Saxony is in Germany, right? Angles came from Scandinavia, right? So this is why when you look at the features of the English people, they look quite different to the Welsh. The Welsh are the Celts. The Celts were the actual original people of this land. And they were driven westwards by the migration of Angles and Saxons. Okay? And this happened after the Romans were here. Okay? So Anglo-Saxons came together, intermarried, and then a new identity arose, and people started to refer to themselves as Angles. Angles, right? And then it became Angleland. England was not England, it was Angleland. Okay, Angleland turned into England with I. Okay, I-N-G-L-A-N-D. And then I turned into E later on, so it became England. Like this part we are talking about of the British Isle, right? So one of the most powerful English kings who was alive in the 8th century, almost a century after Prophet Muhammad passed away, right? The first person to mention in England, the first person to mention Muslims in England was a man called Bede the Venerable. Have you heard of Bede? He was writing in 730s. He had noticed that the Muslims, he used the word Saracens and not Muslims. Saracens were the word used for the Arabs, or the people of the Arabs. They have appeared in France. So he noticed, he heard that Saracens have appeared in France. And he was possibly talking about a battle that took place in a place called Tours, the Battle of Tours, the Battle of Poitiers, between Charles Martel and some of the Arabs who came from Spain. Right, so he talked about that. Then we have Offa, King Offa, who governed from the year 756 to 796. So how many years is that? 40 years? Yes? 40 years. So this was one of the first English kings to have accumulated a lot of power and influence. So he governed a province of a small chunk of land called Mercia, right? And he minted coins. And the first gold coin ever minted by an English king, the first gold coin ever minted by an English king was a copy of an Abbasid dinar. So if you picked up an Abbasid dinar from Banu Abbas, a dinar of the Caliph Al-Mahdi, for example, or Harun al-Rashid, who governed in Baghdad, the first English gold coin ever minted in history was a copy of an Islamic dinar with the formula, now listen carefully, with the formula Muhammad Rasulullah written clearly on it. And the coin can be found in the British Museum. If you go to the British Museum in London, if you go to the money gallery, you ask for office coin, it will be shown to you. It's a coin, gold coin of almost just over 4 grams of gold, and it has the formula written on it, Muhammad Rasulullah. Okay, and if you turn it upside down, it states Offa Rex in Latin, which means King Offa. So this is a very interesting appearance. This is the first evidence of some Islamic influence we see in the British Isles. And this is when English identity was being formed, or even the British identity was being formed. And it doesn't stop there. There's a book written by a lady, forgot her name. She has written a book specifically on this topic, Islam and Anglo-Saxons. Then what happens is we start to find hordes of coins, Islamic dirhams, buried all over East Anglia. You know where East Anglia is? Is this part of East Anglia? No? You're saying no as if you know the geography of Britain. But I think this is East Anglia, isn't it? Is it East Anglia? No?
It's Norwich.
Norwich is East Anglia, I know. Norwich is East Anglia. Okay. So, although this is East, it is Eastern. So it's Southeast. Okay. Right. So all over East Anglia we find hordes of coins buried. And these coins were brought by, in some cases, by Vikings who were invading East Anglia every now and then. You know, there was a place called Lindisfarne, and it's known for gospels written there. There was a monastery there, the Lindisfarne monastery, and many monks have written some absolutely amazing manuscripts. And they can be found in the British Library. If you go there, you will find some of the Gospels written by them in beautiful writing, beautifully illuminated bindings, and some beautiful work. It was destroyed by the Vikings. The Vikings were coming in, and Vikings were bringing these coins with them, and fur and other things to the Middle Easterns in return for money and coins, and a lot of this silver. Islamic dirhams, by the way, minted in Baghdad in some cases. Minted in places like Baghdad, they were found buried in Britain, in East Anglia. So Islam has been there, and then Middle Ages, this continues when Muslims established educational institutes in Spain. A lot of English scholars were traveling there, and the Arabic language became the lingua franca of the learned world at the time for almost 5 centuries. If you did not know the Arabic language, you could not be seen as an educated person, just like the English language has become the lingua franca of the world today. The English language is the most commonly spoken language on the planet, amazingly. Okay, you go anywhere in the world, you may, you know, be able to speak to someone in the English language. Because even in India, believe it or not, in India, the Indians do not talk to each other in Hindi. They use the English language. So someone from the North India, when he or she goes to the South of India, you know, because the southerners do not know Hindi. They don't know how to speak Hindi language. They do know the English language. So they talk to each other in the English language. So English language has become the lingua franca of the world. Now coming to the vision. My introduction has gone too long. I think my introduction has become the entire book itself, right? So let me do the first chapter now, very quickly. Wow. So, this is what Islam has done in the past. There's a lot I can talk about. If you want to talk about poetry, if you want to talk about literature, science, there are books, chunky volumes written on these subjects in particular. Even on literature, there's a lady who has written a book on how Muslim, the Arabic poetry inspired European poetical tradition known as the troubadour tradition. Her name is Maria Rosa Menocal. She is an Arabist, a Spanish Arabist, and she has found direct links between the Arabic poetry in fashion in Spain and the European troubadour tradition in Europe. And even Chaucer, Geoffrey Chaucer, was directly inspired by troubadour tradition, and Shakespeare was inspired by Chaucer in return. So there is a lot of link. There's a lot you can find, even etymology. You know what etymology is? How language is formed. So even in the English language, we have words that come directly from the Arabic language. Directly from the Arabic language. Any examples? Can you give me any examples? Anyone who knows? Maybe you have never thought about this before. The word camel is jamal. The word cat is int in Arabic language. The word earth, the planet earth, it is al-ard. It is in the Quran. Okay? So, the word sugar is sukkar. Okay? Anything else? Any other words can you think of? Sorry?
Kumra is camera.
Okay. Okay, kumra. Okay. What is mirror? Mirat in Arabic language. Okay? So, the English language. So, if you ever come across someone from the EDL or Britain First or people like that who are running around protesting in front of mosques and telling the Muslims that you are, you know, so take them on the side calmly and have a discussion with them. And ask them to stop speaking the English language. Stop speaking the English language, because the language itself has borrowed so much from the Arabic language. And the Arabic language has borrowed so much from other cultures. Not something peculiar to the English language. The Arabs have, the Quran has words in it which do not come from the Arabs. The word Injil, it is actually Evangelos. It is Greek. The word Injil is an Arabized version of the word Evangelos. Right? The word Torah, it is Hebrew. Okay, firstly, the Hebrew and the Arabic and Aramaic languages are sister languages. These are Semitic languages. They're very similar to each other, right? But the Arabic language has adopted words from other language. And when those words have become Arabized, they become the Arabic language, right? Likewise, the word earth is the English language. The word sugar is the English language. But it has come from another language. So when you study the etymology of these words, you come to realize that these words have come from... So this is why cultures always influence each other. People influence each other. Sometimes positively, sometimes negatively. And I'm talking about positive things Islam has done for not only Britain, for the rest of Europe, and for the world at large. So when people throw this thing at you nowadays, that you somehow, because you wear hijab or you have a beard, you must sympathize with something that's happening in the Middle East, or you may be one of these people, we look at you with suspicion, we must spy on you, we must look at you. You know, so you need to talk to them. Firstly, you need to educate yourselves about your own contribution, what you have done. That, you know, what's happening now in the Middle East, it only came about 5 years ago, right? It started to happen 5 years ago. We have a civilization that goes back 1,000 years ago, right? The Islamic civilization is at least 1,000 years old, right? So let's start talking about that. If you want to talk about Islam and what Islam has done globally in the world, historically, let's start talking about the great things Muslims have achieved. And this is what we look up to. So now come to vision. Muslims without a vision today, because we lack knowledge of our history, we have no vision. Generally speaking, the Muslim masses, I'm not talking about individuals, I'm not talking about exceptions, I'm talking about the norm. I have traveled from Morocco to Pakistan. Why Pakistan? Because I cannot go to India. And Bangladesh is too far. Okay? So I would mention Bangladesh as well, because it's the other end of the Muslim world. Right? So I have traveled throughout these Muslim countries and I see a problem. I see a problem. I see a lack of vision. Muslims simply lack knowledge of their history. They have no idea what was achieved in the past. And because they have no idea as to what was achieved in the past, they have no desire to do similar things in the future. Because if you are completely ignorant of your past, you will never have a desire to do those great things in the future. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? That's why Malcolm X, he said, if you want to oppress, suppress, or abuse a people, just take the history away from them. Take the history away from them and they will never know what they should do in the future. Because they have no idea about the past. So for this reason, past is very important, you know. And when I talk about vision, with your educations, what does this university specialize in? Science?
Law.
Law? Okay, law. And? Sorry? Sorry, what?
Arts.
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 Okay. So let me start. What are you doing here?
Maths.
Maths. Brother next to you.
Psychology.
Psychology, okay, great.
Computer.
Computer?
Computer science.
Computer sciences, okay. Same. Business. So, okay, there is this diversity, right? There are a lot of subjects you are studying in this university. And one thing I would like to really share with you very quickly, because you are students in this university, always respect your teacher or teachers. Okay? Never mock your teachers, never think ill of them, or never look down upon them. Whether it is based on religion, culture, or race. Never ever make that mistake, because the first point in knowledge is to respect authority and is to respect your teachers. And this is the lesson we learn from our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Okay? Anyone who does not respect or did not respect his or her teachers will never be able to benefit from his or her knowledge. Never. That's the first point. Have maximum respect and honor for your teachers. I've been taught by a number of different people. I'm still being taught at the University of London. Some of my teachers are some of the greatest people on the planet, primarily because of the way they teach. One of them is Dr. Hugh Kennedy. I'm really inspired by his character and his passion for his field. And he teaches at the University, SOAS, School of Oriental and African Studies, and he's teaching history. And he just makes you fall in love with the subject, right? But even if you do not like the style of a teacher, do not give up. Continue and respect your teachers. And when you learn your knowledge, when you take your knowledge, you have accumulated a considerable amount of knowledge. By the time you have your degree, you'll be on a level where you can actually do something. Now what is the question? This is the point I want to address. This is where the vision comes in, and I'll be ending very soon. Now what is the point? Once you have your degree in your hand, do you want to be one of those people who stand and say, I have no idea what I'm going to do with this piece of paper? I've done a degree in science, but I'm going to go in sports. I've got a degree in law, but I'm going to go and work in a chips shop. I'm going to sell fish and chips, right? I've got my degree in psychology, and I'm going to go and work as, what can we work? If you have a degree in psychology, right? I'm going to go and work as what? A barber, right? Or a bus driver, right? Yeah. Is that fair with your knowledge and your education? So if you do not have a vision, start to have a vision. Now, let me tell you about vision. We as Muslims, when you look at the world at large, okay, you look at organizations like Greenpeace, you look at major charity networks, although Muslims are some of the most charitable people in Britain, especially in the month of Ramadan, we give hundreds of millions of pounds in charity, no doubt, right? But what we do is, we have an attitude. We give charity and we sit back. We don't indulge. We don't actually go and take part physically ourselves in the world. Now, this is where vision comes in. Your degrees are not for you to fill your stomachs. That's not the purpose. Mm-hmm. That's not the purpose. Your degrees, the purpose is to enable you to go and do something in the world. Something global. Something not something local. Okay, stop thinking your dinner table. Stop thinking your bedroom. Stop thinking that. Start thinking global. Start thinking countries. Start thinking solving the problems out in the best way possible, positively, contributing positively. There is a lot of negativity in this world, unfortunately, today. We have too many negative things happening, and they are having a very negative effect on our minds. When we turn on the news, you get depressed, right or wrong? Yes? You get depressed. Okay? Do not allow these things to change your future for the worst. Change your future for the best. And how can you do it? You have a degree, now you should know how to use it to make this world a better place. I can give you a few options. This is what I'm talking about, vision. Do not just die with a big stomach, sitting on a sofa, watching TV, having popcorns and watching what movie? Mission Impossible 50, number 50? Because they don't stop, they keep coming out. Yeah, or James Bond, something like that, you know? Because everyone is, you know, watching something like, what program do you have? Diaries of Olympic, Wimpy Kid? Okay, something like that. People are spending time and watching football. They will sit, and we had to go through the displeasure of watching that debate the day before yesterday, the American presidential debate. I was so disappointed. I was so disappointed. And is this what we have? Are these the people who are going to run the most powerful country in the world with the most powerful resources? Is this what we're left with? Again, depression, but I don't want to depress you. So the point is, what are you doing as an individual? Okay, don't blame that power or this institution and that institution. What are you doing with your degree? Did you have it? Did you take it for having popcorns and living your life working at a desk for the rest of your life? Which is fine, you can do it if you have a vision. What is your vision in life? As an individual, I want you all to think, before you leave this room tonight, what do you want to do with your education and your life? How do you want to die? There are children on the streets of Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. almost half a million children, orphans, walking around sniffing glue. Some of them are on drugs. And if I was to give you more details, you wouldn't be able to take them, what they go through on a daily basis. There are children sold into prostitution as young as 5 and 6. Not only in Brazil, in India. In India, there are 500,000 children. I'm only talking about children. I haven't mentioned other problems. We have a lot more problems in the world. And Britain is one of the most powerful countries in the world. It has more education, more resources, more means for us to go and make a difference in the world. Right or wrong? Right? You can travel, right? You have no travel restrictions. You can use your travel documents, the British passport, to travel around the world. You are not, of course, you are Muslim, so it is very likely that you may be stopped. And this is a problem we Muslims do face. Let's be straight about it. Let's be honest about this. And it's not something I'm bringing up. You read news every single day. Go and read Telegraph, Daily Telegraph, and Independent, and all these newspapers, and you will see Shah Rukh Khan was stopped in the US. You know who Shah Rukh Khan is?
Yes?
Of course you do. And there's this guy, Rizwan. What's his name? Rizwan what? He's made a new... He's an actor. He was stopped, held for hours, right? So this is something normal. But don't let this stop you from doing good work. You can go to Africa. People are dying just because they do not have paracetamol. They do not have simple medicines. I've been to Africa in many countries, in Malawi, in Mozambique, in Tanzania, in Uganda. I've been to Africa. They do not have simple things. Just because someone with a degree left the university, had a party, and then went about his own business, didn't care about what's happening in the world. You know, this world is a vessel. You know a vessel? Yes? It's a vessel. And we are all riding it. We are all in it together, right or wrong?
Right.
Yes? Now we have a problem. You know this this man called Leonardo DiCaprio? Yes? You know him, right?
Yeah.
Of course you do. DiCaprio is going around the world and he is looking at the problem of global warming. Have you come across his work?
Yeah.
Right? And this is one of the biggest problems we're facing. What are we doing about it? Positively, what are we doing about it? Right? How is your degree going to contribute towards making this world a better place? How is your person, when you leave this university, going to contribute towards making this world a better place? Whether it is something small or big is not in your hands. What you do may be very small, or what you may do in the future may be very small. You may make a very small contribution. Now, have you heard of a man called William Wilberforce? And you all know DiCaprio. William Wilberforce was a British MP in the late 18th century, 1700s. 1790s. He died in 1832, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. Wilberforce was a single voice in the British Parliament, or the most prominent voice, not the only voice, definitely, the most prominent voice in the British Parliament, standing up for the rights of slaves who were picked up from Africa, taken across the Atlantic Ocean, put into slavery in the Americas. And average lifetime of a slave, an African slave, a West African slave, was 24 years. You could take a strong Mandingo man with giant muscles. Someone looking like who? Are you? Are you from West Africa?
Alhamdulillah, from East Africa.
You could take a strong guy from Africa, put him into sugar plantation in Jamaica or in Bahamas or in Barbados or in Brazil. He would die within 2 to 3 years. He would be worked to death. So who was standing up for their rights? So William Wilberforce in Britain started the process. He said, this is an absolute travesty. This is oppression of the worst kind. And the abolition movement started, or it became very prominent in the British history at that time. And he didn't give up. Majority of the British Parliament was against him. You know why? Because most of them had investments in the Caribbean, in sugar plantations. They were making money from it. So they could not. They knew what they were doing was evil. It was wrong. It was immoral. It was unethical. It was murder of the worst kind. It was one of the biggest genocides in the history of humanity. Everyone talks about the Holocaust. Everyone talks about other catastrophes, rightly so, in the history of humanity. No doubt. Rightly so. We should. right? But the biggest catastrophe in the history of humanity, which was the Atlantic slave trade, which continued for four centuries, and it reached its peak during the Enlightenment period. You know, when is the Enlightenment period? The 18th century, the mid 18th century. It reached its peak at that time. And that's when William Wilberforce stood up and he did what he did. For that, to see what he did, I strongly recommend, I know most of you may not have the stamina to go and read a book, ironically, out of all people, believe it or not. You know William Hague?
Yes.
William Hague?
Yes.
Who was he?
Foreign Secretary.
Right? Ironically, all of out of all people, he's the one who wrote one of the biographies of William Wilberforce. I don't understand how, what he learned from that biography is very difficult for me to comprehend, okay? Because his later actions, they don't make sense, because he knows what justice and what morality is, having studied and read and written about someone like William Wilberforce, right? But anyway, there's a movie called Amazing Grace. Has anyone watched it? Anyone? You've watched it? You have?
Yes.
Amazing Grace, right? I strongly recommend this movie. It's an amazing story. It's historically accurate, as far as I know. And it is a story of William Wilberforce's struggle. So, I'm giving you an example. Look at this man. One man in the late 18th century in Britain who was rebuked, even pushed around by his own colleagues and mocked for trying to do something that was undoable. Undoable. You will never succeed. You are trying to change the global system, of the global economic system, because a lot of major economies depended on slave trade. Okay, for a number of reasons. I don't want to turn this lecture into a history of slave trade, but he was out to do something undoable. And by the year 1807, he had managed to abolish slavery in the British domains. That meant a large part of the planet. Britain had become a huge power by the early 19th century. Okay, and abolition of slave trade in British domains meant abolition in nearly half the planet. Okay, and this was one man, William Wilberforce. And you think you can't do it? There's no more, I mean, not that slavery, we still have slavery, it still exists in the world. Believe it or not, it still exists in the world. In some cases, even far worse than we had with the Atlantic slave trade. The reason why I gave this example is that you people can also achieve similar things. When you start, don't think you're alone, you're small, you cannot achieve great things in life. So some of you may come and take care of a city and take all the orphans under my custody or under my supervision. You can do it. You can do it. If you want to do it, if you have the will, you will do it. Let's say, and you may start with one city. Let's say, take Brazil as an example. You do not want any more children to be sold into prostitution in Brazil. That's your mission in life. It's an example. Is it a good example?
Yes.
Yes? It's an example. Is it doable? I am only 21 years old, girl or a boy. I've only left the university. I don't even know where to go. But having a vision doesn't mean that you're going to achieve it in 1 or 2 or 3 years. No. No. It means a lifetime commitment. In your lifetime, you may be able to do something which others could not do. We have many examples. Many, many examples I can give in the history of the world. Right? Where people stood for the best, for the right, and they achieved it. And if they did not achieve it in their lifetime, it was achieved after them. It was achieved after them. Right? So, when you die, leave a positive legacy behind in this world so that you are remembered like I am talking about William Wilberforce today. He died nearly 2 centuries ago. Right? But I have deep respect for the man. And we have many Muslim examples. Many Muslim examples are scholars who have written chunky volumes, having sleepless nights, some of them going blind, writing books for you to study. And we put them on shelves so that they look beautiful. And then every now and then remove dust. But don't pick up and read them. So that we can take inspiration from them. I've talked for a very long time. I hope I have made my points very clear. If you go away tonight, forget about all the other gibberish I may have talked about. Forget about it. If you go away tonight with one point in mind, that when you leave this university, you will have a vision. And you will stick to that vision for the rest of your lives. And you will do whatever you can in your capacity to contribute positively to the well-being of humanity at large. If you walk away with that point in your mind, I have achieved my purpose of visiting Canterbury today, apart from seeing the cathedral. And this is what Islam stands for. This is what I have learned from Islam. This is what I have learned from the Prophet. I do not believe in living a purposeless life. Rather, I would love to live a purposeful life. And what I'm doing right now is my vision. I want to go around the world and talk to people about visions. And every single vision they have, as a result of me sharing my vision with them, I will be rewarded for their visions too. Do you agree?
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. The first question, the first one to put the question will get £5 from me. I'll tell you why, because the first question kicks off the process. And then everyone starts asking questions.
Yes. No, I don't have any £5, sorry.
I'm just saying, you raise really good points, but one thing Muslims have in mind constantly is, how do I get the balance? So how do I get the balance of, okay, chasing the vision of doing good with my degree, but how do I get the balance of doing deen and dunya at the same time?
Okay. Deen, what you mean by deen is religion, right? Yeah. Our faith, okay? And dunya is our worldly living, basically, our, how we live in the world. Deen is for the dunya, by the way. This is what people don't understand. Deen is for this dunya, okay? So, even the deen conditions you, your faith. For example, when you go to the masjid, to the mosque, and you pray 5 times a day, what does God want from you? Is it just rituals? Go and bang your head on the floor 5 times a day and you go home and not take any lessons from your prayer? Is that what it is? And unfortunately, that's what it has become. We have completely lost the meaning of prayer. So what are you actually reading in the prayer, right? Allah, you see, this is it. On the day of judgment, because we believe in the day of judgment. We as Muslims, I believe God exists and we will face Him when we die with our actions, right? So on the day of judgment, we'll be asked, did you read your prayers? Yes, I did. What did you read in it? I read Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, Maliki Yawm al-Din. Okay, what did you read after that? أَرَأَيْتَ الَّذِي يُكَذِّبُ بِالدِّينِ فَذَلِكَ الَّذِي يَدُعُ الْيَتِيمُ وَلَا يَحُدُّ وَلَا تَعَامِ الْمِسْكِينِ. Do you not see those who deny his faith? They do not feed the poor and do not take care of the orphan. Oh, you read that? Yes, I did, Ya Allah. I did read it. I read it. Did you do anything for the poor and the orphans? No, I could. Okay, I was too. Okay. So what case do you have in front of you? What case do you have in front of Allah? You're reading these verses every single day without knowing the meaning of what you're reading. And if you don't know the meaning, if you don't contemplate on the meaning, how will you ever act upon it? How will you ever act upon it? So the Quran is full of vision. It is all vision. Quran is giving you directions. Okay, you can do this, you can do that, you can do this. You can feed an orphan. You can take care of a widow. You can feed someone poor around the corner or maybe another country. Okay, you can make this world a better place by educating the world. You can do so many things with your life. So your deen is actually for your dunya. to fix the dunya, to make this world a better place. If your faith, if your belief in Allah is not making your life better, or is not making this world a better place through you, then your faith is not benefiting you. Sorry to burst your bubble. It is not benefiting you. It is not ritual. Islam is not ritual. It's not going and washing properly. Or maybe one corner has, you know, it's not wet enough. Let me wash it again 5 times, right? People are more worried about how, you know, my ihram is tight, whether it's, you know, whether there is a spot on my ihram or not. It's like people who came, some people from Iraq, they went for Hajj, the pilgrimage, right? And you know, it is not allowed to kill anything on the Hajj, even a fly, you know that, right? Yes? So some people went to Abdullah bin Umar, one of the companions of the Prophet, and they asked him, is it allowed to kill a mosquito? Right? Is it allowed to kill a mosquito on Hajj? And he asked them, where did you come from? They said, we have come from Iraq. He said, look at you people. You killed the grandson of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and did not ask questions. And today you're asking me about whether you can kill a mosquito or not. Are you joking? So this is the condition we're in today, right? We cannot see orphans dying in Brazil. We cannot see people dying in let's say Syria or Africa, or even places like Honduras. Places like, have you heard of Nicaragua? I bet you don't know where it's on the map. I bet you don't know where it's on the map. You wouldn't know. Right?
Near the Americas.
Sorry?
Nicaragua, I think.
Of course it's in Americas.
Yeah.
Where?
Venezuela.
Huh?
Central America.
Central America.
South America.
What? Next to what country?
I don't know.
Exactly.
Colombia?
Close enough. This part, you know, there are people suffering there. There is a drugs problem there. There is violence. What can you do? How can you make that place more peaceful? It's not my problem. I'm a Muslim. You're not Muslim. No, they are your problem. You are the mercy to the world, right? Remember the Quran. What does the Quran tell you? وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَاكَ إِلَّا رَحْمَةً لِلْعَالَمِينَ. We sent you not except as a mercy for the world, right? Are you the mercy for the world, right? Okay. Is it only the Muslim world? Is the world only Muslim? No. There are other people there. They need your help. Go and help them. So this is something we need to learn. You know, thank you for that question. That this faith, our faith, al-Islam, is for the dunya. If it's not making your dunya better, like Shaykh al-Islam ibn Taymiyyah, he said that if you do not have paradise in this world, you will not have paradise in that world. What does he mean by that? What does he mean by that? If you could not make your life better, mentally, psychologically, spiritually, if you're not at peace in this world, because paradise is actually primarily, more importantly, peace, right? You won't see a war in paradise. You won't see any disputes, any bickering, any backbiting, any fighting, any, you know, anything negative. If you don't have that sense of tranquility, spiritual peace in this world, then you may not have it in that world. So this is why it's very important to attain peace by giving peace. You know, when you give peace, that's the best way to get peace. Give peace to people. Share love, share peace, share compassion through your knowledge, through your credentials, through your education, through your money, whatever you do. Have a vision in life. Okay, you may have a vision, I'll take care of one orphan. Alas, no problem. It's a beautiful vision. At least you're doing something in life. Make your life a mission. When I leave this university, I'll focus on one orphan, or maybe 10 orphans, and I'll make a mission of my life, among other things you may be doing in your life. I will make sure that these orphans have a good life, good education, have good futures, and then you give them 10 more visions, and they will do the job for you later on. This is it. This is why the Islamic civilization was so special. They were people of vision. They were not lazy bunch of popcorn eating, movie watching, football watching, sorry, don't mean to insult you. Maybe you some of you guys might love football, right? But that's not what you're born for. Fine, have your fun. Go on, have fun, go have parties, halal ones, right? And watch football, if you want, watch movies, halal ones, yeah. Go and watch them, okay? But don't lose focus. There is a vision. You have been given a purpose, right? What's your purpose? Fulfill your purpose. Your purpose is to worship Allah and find the best way to worship for yourselves. And amazingly, when we look at the life of the Prophet, most of the time when Jannah, paradise, is promised, it is for social things. Have you noticed? Who was promised Jannah a number of times? One of the companions? Uthman.
Ali.
Umar, Abu Bakr. Why? Doing social things. Uthman gave a well of water for the people of Medina. The Prophet said, who will buy this well and give it for the people? Right? And Uthman said, I will do it. And he was promised Jannah for that. Did Prophet ﷺ ever promise Jannah? Especially for praying five times a day. Although we know the reward is Jannah for that. We know. But did he ever specially say, because this companion of mine prays five times a day, every day, he's promised Jannah? Mm. Can you find me an example? No. But you will see him saying, he did charity, he will be in Jannah. He took anyone who takes care of an orphan. The Prophet ﷺ said, Ana wa kafil yateem fil Jannah ka hatain. I am the one who takes care of one orphan will be in paradise like this close. One orphan can take you to Jannah. One orphan. So, deen is dunya. Anyone else? Yes, please.
You mentioned two books. One was The Matter of Araghi by Dorothy Medilsky.
Metzlitsky.
Yeah. And
the
other one, I didn't catch that one, which is...
I mentioned few. Which other one was that?
The one right before you mentioned The Matter of Araghi.
Did anyone note it?
Islam and the West,
making of an image Norman Daniel. There is another one called Islam in the West. It is by Christopher. It is a very interesting book. I forgot the name of the author. Christopher, Islam and the West. It's another one. His first name is Christopher. I don't remember his surname, second name.
I
can't remember. Okay, anyone else? Yes, please.
I know that one thing, we've heard it said tonight, inshallah, if God wills it. And I'm not a Muslim, but I understand that for people who are Muslims, particularly if you're a Sunni Muslim, the will of God is really important.
Yes.
And sometimes people say in Islam, there's what they say is determinism, the idea that God makes happen the things that happen in the world.
Yes.
Now, you said you've travelled in parts of the Muslim world, and sometimes you're not happy because you see a lack of vision, a lack of fulfilment.
Yeah.
Do you think the inshallah attitude sometimes can get in the way of people fulfilling their vision? Is there a tension between people saying, oh, maybe it's God's will that I sit eating popcorn watching the movies, rather than fulfilling their vision? In other words, is there a theological problem?
That's a very, very good question. And this very question was put to the Prophet himself, that now that we believe in the destiny of God, right, that everything has been decreed, shall we now sit back and do nothing and not even pray for our situations to change? And the Prophet responded by saying that even you raising your hands in prayer has been predetermined. In other words, that even your initiative has been predetermined. So it's not that we should not take initiative to change our situations. To the contrary, in Islam, one of the basic amal, action. Because Iman, in fact, the very basic definition of Iman, which we mean, which means faith in God. What is faith? Okay, I know there is Christian understanding and there is Islamic understanding, and I don't know what the Jewish understanding of the word faith is. But But faith to Muslims is, it comes in three dimensions. And I will state them in Arabic and then translate them. Qawlun bil lisan, actually declaring it from your tongue, or on your tongue, right? Wa tasdeekun bil janan, and accepting it wholeheartedly. You just can't say something you don't believe. So you have to accept it. You have to accept it wholeheartedly. You have to be sincere about your declaration. So it is saying, believing, and then wa amalun bil arkan, acting upon it. This is iman in Islam. So if you believe and do not act, you do not actually believe, Islamically speaking. So this is why the issue of predetermination is very often misunderstood, even by Muslims. So inshallah, the word inshallah has actually become a joke in the Muslim world. You know, when some of the Arabs actually say inshallah, it means they don't actually mean to do what they said they would do, right? So so it's just one of those common things we mention when we're talking, right? So when we say something, it has become habitual rather than actual. It's not, we don't actually mean it anymore, unfortunately. So when we say, I'll see you in a week, inshallah, okay? That inshallah doesn't actually mean, inshallah, I definitely intend to meet you next week at this time in this place. No, it doesn't mean that. Inshallah has become a habitual thing. It is just a habit now of people saying it. Okay, they don't actually think about the belief of it. They don't actually contemplate on the words. Most people, most Muslims on the planet, non-Arab Muslims, don't even understand and don't even know what inshallah is. They don't know. It's just one of those things you say culturally or traditionally when you make a promise or when you intend to do something. But the issue of predetermination is not a problem, because we have a very clear explanation from the Prophet in this regard, that you do not leave things to roll on themselves. Rather, you take initiative, and even your initiative has been predetermined. But you are not aware of what God has determined. Okay? So, God has his predetermination, no doubt. God, and in what sense? In what sense? How does that predetermination work? God has knowledge of everything. God knows what's going to happen. Okay? But that doesn't mean that he forces you to do your actions. Him having knowledge of things does not mean that he forces you to do your actions. Right? So, because he has knowledge of things and we don't have knowledge of what he has knowledge of, doesn't mean that we don't do nothing. We continue doing the good deeds we do, start changing the bad things into good things, and God knows what he has determined for us. Results are only known to God, not to us. So we do our best and leave the rest to God. This is how we act. I hope that makes sense. Okay. Anyone else?
You were saying earlier about having a vision, and I was going to ask you, with so much going on in the world around us, and
yeah,
being a bit fast-paced,
yeah,
and sometimes your vision can get a bit blurry with so much like cloud to come in. So can you give us any practical examples of things that you have done which
will
help you remind you your vision?
I'm a human being and I have problems in life, like anyone else. I have many issues in life. I have a big family. Things come and hit me every now and then. Someone has died in the family, someone is ill, one of my kids is not feeling well. All these things happen to me as well. Okay? Even when I watch the news, it hurts me a lot. When I watch what's happening in Syria, how many people have been killed, and no one is doing anything in the world. When I say anything, I mean effective enough. There are people with a lot of power, they are not bothered. They don't want to stop. I believe if the world took action in time, we would have had millions of more Jews in the world today. During the Second World War, 6 million Jews were killed, or the Jewish people were killed by Hitler, because the world did not take action in time. Likewise, there's a genocide taking place in Syria. The world is sitting and watching. There are kids being pulled out of rubble with missing bits. The world is watching. So not enough is being done. It disturbs me. But I still do not lose my focus. I know I do not have power to change those things. And I will be questioned about what I could do in my power. What can I do? The question is, what can you do with your degree? That's the question. Don't think about the earthquake in let's say, you know, in Haiti or in Turkey or in Pakistan. Or why did you stop? God, on the day of judgment, Allah will not ask you as to why you didn't stop the earthquake. You can't. But you will be questioned about, what did you do for those people? What did you do for those people? Could you do something in your power? Allah knows your capacity. You know your capacity, right? So where do you come from originally?
Somalia.
Your country needs you. Your people need you. You go and fix the situation. It's in chaos. Every single place, Britain, we, us living in Britain, Britain has problems. It has social issues. Do you know there are people who die in winter in this country of cold? Did you know that? Did you know that?
Up north,
yeah. Huh?
Up north.
Even down south. People die. They found a dead body in Bournemouth. You know Bournemouth? Right? They found a dead body of a woman. She was in there for 5 years. She was rotting in there for 5 years. And when the bailiffs broke down the door because the bill wasn't paid or something like that, they found the body. It was in the news. Why? Because the neighbors do not know each other. They don't know what's happening next door. Because we're selfish. Because we are a selfish people. So here in Britain you can do so much. You can go out looking for people who need help. There are so many elderly people, pensioners, who can't even go and do their own shopping. Have you heard of the story of the Jewish woman?
Yeah.
Abu Bakr would come and clean her house. She was blind. She couldn't do her work herself. Abu Bakr, the leader of the Muslims, would come and clean the house without her realizing who's doing it. She would know someone's doing it, but she wouldn't know who's doing it. So there are examples like that. This is the legacy we inherited. Are we actually doing justice to it? No. So there are so many things, you know. So don't lose focus. In life, have a focus. You will be hit on the right cheek, on the left cheek, you'll be hit from behind, you'll be hit from the front, you know, with all kind of things happening in your life. Your car broke down, the tree fell on your car, yeah, or you know, someone in the family, something happened. Don't lose your focus. Remain focused. Look at the Prophet's life. Look at his life. He was in the Battle of Badr, his daughter was dying in Medina. Did you know that? Uthman was not in the Battle of Badr. Uthman bin Affan was not in the Battle of Badr. Why? Because his wife was dying. The Prophet left him with his wife to take care of her. When he came back, she was already buried. Did he lose focus? His daughter was dying. His own wife died, Khadija, because of the boycott. He was thrown out of the city of Mecca for 3 years. You know the Shah Abu Talib, the boycott, 3 years. Thrown out. Boiling shoes. Boiling leather from his shoes. Has no food. Eating dead camels. Eating leaf from trees. You know, it is easy for me to say it. You know, to say the words is easy. But when you are put through that situation for 3 long years with his wife, you know, someone who is very strong, you have very strong nerves, you can take difficulties. But you cannot watch your own wife and your children suffer. Very few people would be able to see their own. His wife was dying in front of him. And what was the demand? Stop preaching Islam. Stop preaching Islam. That's all he had to do. He said, it is not my choice. It is not my choice. I cannot stop. So he didn't lose focus. He had problems. So problems should not, you know, whether the problems in Syria, in Brazil, or in Africa, somewhere, wherever, you should not lose your focus. So long as you live, you should continue to focus. Have a focus, stick to it. You may change your focus. You may change your vision. If it's not working, change your strategies, change your ways. be flexible about doing things, but do them positively, do them the right way. That's all I'm asking you to do. Okay, but the time is up, and I have to go and look at the computer as well. I know it's going to be closed, huh? But I still have to look at it, because this is the first time I've come to Canterbury, and I don't know when I'm going to come back, so I want to go look at it. So thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.
It's been...